regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. You know the drill by now. My name is Cam Edwards. It is great to have you with us. Coming up on the program in just a couple of minutes, Caleb Kruckenberg is going to join us from the New Civil Liberties Alliance. He's an attorney that is representing a Utah man, Clark Apogian, in a challenge to the ATF's ban on bump stocks. Now, the challenge is not on Second Amendment grounds. The challenge is basically that the ATF didn't have the authority under their rules and their laws to ban these items. That this was something that Congress should have banned if they wanted to ban them. But it does raise some interesting questions, and it also, coupled with an email that we're going to get to a little bit later on in the program, kind of demonstrates that the ATF may be playing a little fast and loose with the rules that that they are supposed to be interpreting. Before we get to that interview, though, I do want to let you know about something that's going to be coming up on Monday morning in the state of Virginia. House Bill 961, which is Ralph Northam's gun ban, magazine ban, suppressor ban, trigger activator ban, passed out of the House narrowly just a few days ago. Monday, it's going to get its first Senate hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Now, what's important to note here is that three of the four Democrat state senators who have said that they oppose at least the original language of House Bill 961 sit on that committee. And if all three of them were to vote against this measure, they would be able to defeat it in committee. Actually, if two of them voted to defeat this bill, it would go down in committee. The three senators that are on the committee that have said at least, we're not in favor of the original language of House Bill 961, Senator John Edwards, who is the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Craig Deeds, and Senator Chap Peterson. Now, Senator Deeds and Senator Peterson actually did vote down. They joined Republicans and defeated Ralph Northam's lost or stolen gun bill, Senate Bill 67, which would have imposed civil penalties on gun owners who did not report lost or stolen firearms to police within 24 hours of when they discovered that their firearms had gone missing or should have known that their firearms had gone missing. I think that's a good sign. I don't think it necessarily is a guarantee that House Bill 961 is going to die in committee. Governor Ralph Northam is clearly very committed to trying to get this bill to his desk, willing to do a lot of horse trading. Is he willing to water this bill down even further? Right now, it's a misdemeanor to continue to possess magazines over 12 rounds. If this bill were to become law, it would be a felony to transport those magazines over 12 rounds. But you could, it wouldn't be a felony imposition. Is Ralph Northam willing to grandfather in existing magazines in hopes of bringing these other Democrats on board? I suspect that he is. And I would not be surprised to see amendments offered to this bill in the Senate committee. So one of the things that it's important for Virginia gun owners to communicate with their state senators is that this bill is unacceptable in any form or fashion. Because even if everything's grandfathered in, the state of Virginia is still telling these gun owners, hey, you don't have a right to own these things. We're letting you for now, but you don't have a right to own these things. I mean, look, if somebody moves to the state of Virginia, we're not going to let them own one. So you don't have a right to own one. It's a privilege. This turns the possession of the most commonly owned magazines in the country into a privilege. This places the most commonly produced rifle in the country today outside of the protections of the Second Amendment. It doesn't matter that there's no confiscation component. This bill still infringes on the rights of Virginians to keep and bear arms. What about, look, I may or may not own some of these firearms that they want to ban, just in case they're watching. But let's say that I do. Let's say that I own an AR-15 right now, maybe several. And I would be allowed to keep these guns. But let's say next year, my neighbor, same age as me, also a gun owner like me, let's say he wants to buy an AR-15 for the first time. He's going to be told, no, he can't. That it's against the law for him to buy one, but his neighbor owns one. Well, I'd say that his rights are being infringed. Wouldn't you? So again, it doesn't have to have a confiscation component to be a gun ban. And it's a gun ban bill. And it's a magazine ban bill. and it's a suppressor ban bill, and it's a trigger activator ban bill, and it should die in committee. I hope it dies in committee. I'm knocking on wood, but I'm also going to be picking up the phone and calling my senator to let them know that I stand opposed to House Bill 961. I hope that they do, too. And if you're a Virginia gun owner, I hope that you will do the same. All right, so let's get now to our interview with Caleb Kruckenberg from the New Civil Liberties Alliance, talking about this lawsuit taking on the ATF's bump stock ban. And then we'll get to some of your emails after the conversation. Take a look and a listen. Caleb, thanks so much for coming on the program, sir. It's great talking with you today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about this case that Clark Apogian and you folks with the New Civil Liberties Alliance are engaged in right now. This deals with bump stocks, but you're not actually challenging whether or not bump stocks are bannable here. You're challenging the procedure by which bump stocks were banned federally. Is that correct?
That's right. And my organization, the New Civil Liberties Alliance, we were founded to restore what we believe is constitutionally appropriate lawmaking. And what I mean by that is we think that Congress should make the laws and the executive should enforce them, and agencies like the ATF should not be in the business of writing laws. And unfortunately, what happened with bump stocks is it's not federally illegal to have a bump stock. There's a statute that was written by Congress that doesn't say anything about bump stocks. But the ATF on its own tried to rewrite the law, and they wrote a regulation saying it's now a criminal offense for anyone to have a bump stock. And that's not appropriate. That's not the way laws are supposed to be written. And so that's why we got involved in this case.
You know, and it's interesting, too, because one of the other there's been another topic, I guess, in which the ATF has been brought up lately in terms of taking those shortcuts that you talk about. And it has to do with the definition of a receiver of a firearm. And according to a former ATF official, the ATF has for years been erroneously declaring that, lower receivers on AR-15s meet the federal definition of a receiver, even though they don't. And this is now coming back to bite ATF in the rear end in terms of court cases. You've got judges that are actually tossing cases because the government can't prove its case, can't prove that these individuals are illegally possessing firearms because they're just possessing, a lower receiver, which does not actually meet that definition under federal law. And Caleb, this has been going on for years and years, and it's just now sort of come to light that, again, the ATF could have redefined what a receiver is, but they probably would have had to go through a public comment period, maybe even had to change the law, maybe even had to get Congress involved. And instead of doing that, they just sort of, apparently tried to let this slide by, and now they're being called out on it. As I've been following what's going on with your case and the case of Clark Apogian, it just strikes me that there are a lot of similarities here in terms of, again, those governmental shortcuts, right? Not crossing all the T's, dotting all the I's, things that you and I would get in a lot of trouble for if we tried to do these things and the federal government didn't like it. But when it comes to the federal government doing it, it seems like they can often get away with it.
That's absolutely right. And I think that's a really good example with those cases about the receivers, because it's important to remember those are criminal prosecutions. Those are people that are facing prison sentences, and it's based on something the ATF doesn't have the authority to do. And you're right, it's been going on for years, and there have been prosecutions for decades on that theory. And unfortunately, I think what we're going to see with bump stocks is if the ATF is allowed to get away with what they're doing, with trying to rewrite the law, there are going to be criminal prosecutions in the future. And the ATF estimated there are about 500,000 bump stocks that were legally sold before the ban went into effect. And potentially that's 500,000 people who could look at criminal prosecutions based on what you said, a shortcut.
Yeah.
The ATF's not following what they're supposed to do.
Well, exactly, because those 500,000 folks who bought those bump stocks, they were told, and they were correctly told at the time, that the ATF had approved these items.
Absolutely. And actually, it's my client, Clark Apogian, when he bought his bump stock, it actually came with a laminated copy of the ATF classification letter saying, this device is not prohibited by federal law. It's not a machine gun. It's not regulated. And now the ATF has just turned that around, and they've said, actually, if you listen to our advice, we will send you to prison if you relied on that original letter.
That's just crazy. That's absolutely crazy. So where are we right now in this lawsuit?
So we are on appeal, and unfortunately, we asked the trial court in Utah to stop the rule from going into effect. Unfortunately, we weren't successful. The rule took effect. Now we've asked the Court of Appeals to intervene and declare the rule unlawful. I argued that case in the Court of Appeals in Denver last month, and now we're waiting for a decision. And hopefully we'll get a decision soon. That'll say what we've been saying all along, that this is something the ATF had no authority to do, and their ban is unlawful. And hopefully if we're successful, the ban will be overturned. You know, and there's you can't unring the bell because a lot of these devices have been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're hoping to accomplish is if we can get the court to agree that it's on ATF broke the rules, they can't prosecute people in the future. And that's really what I'm concerned about.
Absolutely. And so what happens on the flip side? What happens if we don't, or if you don't win this case, if the rulemaking by ATF is allowed to stand? I mean, how could that impact the rights of gun owners going forward? It seems to me like that would be a rubber stamp of approval on the court saying that the ATF can arbitrarily go back and redefine whatever it wants. And gun owners are going to be the ones that, you know, the legal law-abiding gun owners are going to be the ones that are hurt by these reclassifications.
I think you're absolutely right. And it sets a very dangerous precedent if the ATF can get away with it. If we're not successful in this lawsuit, we have my organization, the New Civil Liberties Alliance. We have another case that we brought in Texas. It's still at the trial level. And we're going to continue to fight this issue. And, you know, if we get one bad judgment against us, we will fight and try to get a good judgment. And we'll take this to the Supreme Court if we have to. But we're still optimistic that the 10th Circuit will agree with us and they'll do what's right, because I think they understand the stakes.
What does the federal law say? I mean, I know you could probably get into the weeds here and talk for an hour about how the statute is being abused. But what's your sort of elevator pitch as to why the ATF is wrong here?
So the federal law banning machine guns says a machine gun is basically anything where if you hold the trigger, it fires multiple bullets. That's it. I mean, that's sort of a very basic understanding of what a machine gun is. A bump stock, the way it works is you basically have to keep hitting the trigger every time a bullet comes out. And if you're very skilled with a bump stock, you can fire rapidly. But those aren't the same thing. You have to hit the trigger every time for a bump stock for it to fire. And the ATF now is saying, well, even though it's not really a machine gun, even though you have to pull the trigger every time, because you can fire rapidly, we're going to consider that a machine gun. But that's not what the statute says. That's not what Congress decided. And that's why it's improper for them to say that bump stocks are machine guns.
All right. So your point of view is simply that if bump stocks are to be banned, it needs to happen through legislation, not through some sort of agency determination.
Absolutely. And Congress was considering this issue. Mm-hmm. And Congress took up the issue. There were a lot of different bills in Congress. They were bipartisan. And a lot of times what they would do is they would say, well, going forward, we think that bump stocks should be registered or they might be limited in some way. But what's happened is the agency said, we know better than Congress. We're going to make this decision anyway. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to order everyone to destroy their devices. We're going to declare all these people criminals overnight, and then we're going to prosecute them very aggressively. That's not what Congress would have done, because they actually have to answer to their constituents. And this is why the process shouldn't work this way. I mean, it's an abuse of the structure of the Constitution. It's abuse of the way things are supposed to be done.
So tell me a little bit about your organization, the New Civil Liberties Alliance. You know, obviously you're dealing with issues like this, but what is the goal of the New Civil Liberties Alliance, and what are some of the other areas in which you're working?
So our mission is to rein in the administrative state and restore constitutional lawmaking. And so we fight against administrative agencies all over the place and in a lot of different contexts. But it's sort of familiar abuses. It's they try to rewrite laws that they don't have any authority to rewrite. They try to enforce the laws. They try to bully courts into taking their interpretation of the law. And basically what they're doing is these administrative agencies are taking over the roles of the courts, they're taking over the roles of the legislature in a way that the founders never envisioned and never would have stood for.
Mm-hmm.
So we go across the country, we file lawsuits against agencies all over the place, trying to tell them that we're not going to stand for it and we don't approve of the way they're abusing their power.
And, you know, do you see Congress abrogating their responsibility more and more to the administrative state?
Absolutely, because they've gotten away with it for so long. The administrative agencies are so big. A lot of times what you'll see is Congress will write a statute, you know, they'll write a law and they'll say, and we'll let an agency fill in all the details later.
Right.
But what that does is keeps Congress from doing its job, and it keeps them from being accountable. Because they can always say, oh, the tough decisions can be made by an agency. That way my constituents won't come to me. They don't have anything to be upset about because I didn't make that decision.
Yeah.
And so Congress has let this happen. And somebody needs to step in. We have to stop Congress from doing it. We have to stop the agencies from getting away with it. And we have to stop the courts from letting this all happen.
Talking again with Caleb Kruckenberg of the New Civil Liberties Alliance. Caleb, listen, I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for joining me. And I know that you said oral arguments were held in the 10th Circuit last month. So we don't have, obviously, a deadline. The Court of Appeals can issue their ruling whenever they want. But I'm guessing that you're hopeful sometime this spring we'll learn what the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals has to say.
That's right. Hopefully in the next month or so, we'll get a decision. And like I said, I'm optimistic about it.
Well, I will keep my fingers crossed and would love to have you back when that decision does come down one way or the other.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Caleb Kruckenberg joining us from the New Civil Liberties Alliance here on Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. So yeah, we'll continue to follow this story. But as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, it's also worth noting that this is not really the only issue that's come up recently with the ATF. Donna wrote in and asked, would you do a YouTube video on this? And she sent me a link to a story from CNN. And Donna, I do want you to know that I've written about this a couple of times at BearingArms.com. If you've not had a chance to take a look, check it out. Just do a search for, you know, ATF or receivers there at the website. But in essence, what has been going on very quietly over the past few months, and CNN has really been the only national outlet to report on this outside of the Second Amendment news media. There have been a number of court cases that have been thrown out against individuals who were accused of illegal firearm possession because the receivers that they possessed don't meet the federal definition of a firearm, even though the ATF has been claiming that they do. And so there's a former ATF agent, a guy named Robert O'Kelly. He worked for the ATF for a number of years. He was actually, Dan O'Kelly's his name. He was the lead firearms technology instructor at the ATF National Academy for 5 years. And he says, listen, the ATF's definition of a firearm is not compatible with the charges that are being brought against these people because they're possessing a receiver, which does not, an AR-15 receiver, a lower receiver, which does not meet the federal definition of a firearm. And he says he talked to ATF officials about it years ago. He said they did nothing about it. And now he's serving as an expert witness in a lot of trials. Back in December, a federal judge in Ohio dismissed weapons-related charges against two men after O'Kelly testified that the AR-15 part at issue in their case was not subject to federal law or regulation. U.S. District Judge James Carr called the ATF's longstanding interpretation of the regulation, quote, unreasonable and legally unacceptable. ATF said in a statement to CNN it was reviewing that case and others involving the issue and have no further comment until that review is complete. The agency declined to discuss O'Kelley's testimony as an expert witness. So basically, this is how CNN reports it. They say that under the law, Gun Control Act of 1968, manufacturers are required to stamp the frame or the receiver with a serial number for tracing purposes, right? The body of a firearm in the area surrounding the trigger. And an accompanying federal regulation provided a precise, highly technical definition. O'Kelley says that part of a firearm, this is the technical definition, that part of a firearm which provides housing for the hammer, bolt, or breech block and firing mechanism, and which is usually threaded at its forward position to receive the barrel. And O'Kelley says, look, the AR-15 has a split receiver. It's got an upper receiver, it's got a lower receiver. And neither of those receivers meet that requirement on its own. He says, quote, for 50 years, ATF has been making this square peg fit in the round hole when, in fact, it doesn't. And he says that he went to his supervisors decades ago and said, look, there's a problem here. He said that they did nothing. And now, as he's serving as an expert witness, more judges are listening to what he has to say, and they're realizing, oh, yeah. And this is a huge issue. How many people are in prison right now because they were convicted under this definition that did not apply to the receivers or the gun parts that they possessed? I mean, by the way, you would think that a lot of the criminal justice reform advocates might be raising hell about this, but I haven't heard anything. So, Donna, I appreciate you sending me this story. I'm going to try to reach out to Mr. O'Kelley, see if he'll be an expert guest here on Bearing Arms Cam and Company to talk about this issue, because, you know, this is a problem. And I suspect that the reason why the ATF has done nothing to try to, quote, fix this issue is because of the number of prosecutions that admitting it would be impacted if they admit, oh, yeah, we've been using this wrong definition for decades. I mean, that's huge. But it's also huge to now have a lot of these cases getting thrown out because judges say, well, these charges don't fit what happened here. And nobody really seems to want to talk about it, which makes me want to talk about it. So, Donna, I appreciate you writing in. Let's see. Also, Shane writing in with a Second Amendment sanctuary bill in Arizona. Eric wrote in with a couple of bills out of Arizona, one that would, in essence, ban hunting with a semi-automatic firearm, and another that actually is starting to see some movement, a bill that Senate bill that would approve or allow for you to sue local governments if you were hurt in a gun-free zone, and by being in that gun-free zone, you were deprived of the ability to lawfully carry your firearm. That bill has started getting at least a vote and passed out of a committee 4-3. Now it goes to the floor of the state Senate. The other bills that I mentioned here, the Second Amendment sanctuary state legislation, the anti-hunting legislation, those bills have not, they've been introduced. They haven't started moving. So, you know, keep an eye on them. But I suspect that that those bills probably aren't going anywhere in the Arizona legislature, which is pro-gun on paper anyway. Those bills should not really face much chance of success, but we'll keep our eyes on them. Another bill that we're keeping an eye on out in Connecticut, heard from, who was this? Who sent me this? Gosh darn it, I'm sorry. I don't mean to, I can't remember. I can't find the email right now, but there was another email out of Connecticut dealing with a tax on firearms. Oh, this was from Robert. 35% tax, excise tax, on the sale of ammunition, not firearms, ammunition sold in Connecticut. This bill was just introduced. They had a press conference. Moms Demand Action was there. The bill sponsor was there. This is actually the second go-round. Representative Gilchrist introduced a bill last session in Connecticut that would have imposed a 50% tax on ammunition. That went nowhere, And so she's back now with this 35% tax on ammunition. She says the money would be earmarked for, quote unquote, gun violence prevention programs. But don't ask her why legal gun owners should be the only ones paying for those programs when that's an issue that impacts, you know, all of Connecticut, because she will say, how dare you? She literally will say, how dare you? You know, the real victims are the people who are hurt by gun violence. That was her response, which makes no sense as an actual answer to the question. You know, the fact of the matter is, in Connecticut, much like the rest of the United States, legal gun owners are not responsible for a huge amount of violent crime. And if you really want to use these effective gun violence prevention programs or violence prevention programs, why would you tie the funding for those programs to one revenue source, legal gun owners in the state of Connecticut? Which, by the way, legal gun owners in the state of Connecticut, if this bill were to become law, where are they going to go to get their ammunition? Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York, right? Where it's going to be cheaper. And so if you really want these programs to be funded, why would you tie the funding to this particular revenue source, Connecticut's gun owners? Unless you wanted to hurt them, however you could, in this case, in their wallet or their pocketbook. It's absurd. And it shows to me the fundamental unseriousness of this proposal by Representative Gilchrist and the support of Moms Demand Action for this proposal. Because if this really was about public safety, if this really was about stopping people from shooting one another, they wouldn't be tying this funding to the Connecticut gun owners. They would say this is an issue that impacts every one of us who live in the state of Connecticut. Every one of us has an obligation to step up and do our part. But that's not what they're saying at all. They're blaming gun owners. And they're trying to take money out of their pocket to hurt them, I believe. I've had several, by the way, emails, and I won't get to them all, but Ed and Dan and John and several others, thank you for writing in about just, you know, offering prayers and support for my wife, Miss Z. She was supposed to begin her latest round of chemoimmunotherapy today, but shockingly, the insurance company has taken their sweet time and has yet to approve the treatment, so she's on a one-week holding pattern. So I do appreciate the kind words, and thank you again for your prayers and for your thoughts. That is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program today. Don't forget, the email address is cam.edwards@bearingarms.com. We try to answer your emails at least every Friday, if not one or two other days during the week. And don't forget as well, Monday, we're going to have full details of what's happening with House Bill 961 in Virginia. But if you're a Virginia gun owner, make sure that your state senators are hearing from you this weekend. Thanks again for being a part of the program today. You can subscribe to Town Hall Media on YouTube or Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, townhall.com's podcast page. That way you never miss an episode. You can also become a VIP member of BearingArms.com by signing up at BearingArms.com. And not only will you get exclusive commentary, analysis, and more, you will be helping to support the Second Amendment news and information we try to bring to you each and every day. Thanks again for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here Monday with another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company.